So I did some reading and some research and came up with these essays on six of the founding fathers and how the mental maps shaped their agreements, their disagreements, how they their ideas of the new nation that they were trying to create and the young republic that they were trying to get through some difficult times. And the result is this book.
Join the best in the movement. It's Conservative Conversations with ISI, educating for liberty since 1953.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conservative Conversations with Tom Cerouf, and I'm joined today by Michael Barone. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Well, it's good to be with you. I am currently a senior political analyst for the Washington Examiner, formerly with U.S. News and for Washington Post editorial page, the polling firm Peter D. Hart. For 40-some years, I was the principal co-author and founder of the Almanac of American Politics. So I've been writing about American politics and political life for publication, I guess, going back to college for more than 60 years.
Hey there, listener. I wanted to take a quick moment to thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations. This podcast is a production of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, and our mission here at ISI is educating for liberty. If you'd like to join us in fulfilling our mission, consider helping us by rating and reviewing this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, to help us reach more listeners like yourself. Now, back to the show. Excellent. Well, it's great to meet you. It's great to be with you and chatting with you. And I understand that you've got a new book out called The Mental Maps of the Founders, How Geographic Imagination Guided America's Revolutionary Leaders. Well, what's that one about?
Well, I, like many people, I've been reading with great appreciation of wonderful books about the founding fathers that have been published the last 25 or 30 years by academic historians, by non-academics, splendidly written in many cases, deeply researched. And I wanted to learn more. And an old friend, the great reporter and Reagan biographer Lou Cannon, once told me, if you want to really learn about a subject, write a book about it. So I thought, well, what can I contribute as a journalist, someone trained, went to law school years ago, but not a professional historian? What can I contribute to it? And I thought the basic idea I came up with was maps. I mean, we all have mental maps inside our brains, the route that we take to get to the grocery store, or the sandwich takeout place that we go to, which expressway interchange we get off the expressway, so forth. Some of us have very detailed mental maps. I'm a guy that's always been very map-oriented. I have been to all 435 of the 435 congressional districts, and I can get around pretty well in any one of them. It occurred to me that what I might contribute here is to get an idea of the geographic orientation, the mental maps of some of the founding fathers. So I did some reading and some research and came up with these essays on six of the founding fathers and how the mental maps shaped their agreements, their disagreements, how they their ideas of the new nation that they were trying to create and the young republic that they were trying to get through some difficult times. And the result is this book. I mean, it's it turns out that they had rather different geographic orientations. And those turned out to be consequences for people who were starting off, of course, without anything like a geographically complete knowledge of North America.
That's a very interesting concept. And I'd be curious to hear more about what sort of research you did for the book. Like when creating a physical, creating a mental map for a person, what kind of research goes into that wherein you create the mental map?
Well, you obviously want to read a lot about them in various ways, read some of their own words, look through their biographies. I think in each case, I took special care to look into the early years in their lives because that tends to form our mental maps to a considerable extent. You probably remember, your first neighborhood that you were familiar with living in and how you got to the elementary school or whatever it was. And so I took a look through these things, and I looked at the maps that they had with them. And one of the maps that was important, one of the maps that George Washington had access to when he was a surveyor for Lord Fairfax and Lord Fairfax's huge land grant that he had gotten approval of in the courts in London, of everything between the Rappahannock and Potomac rivers from the Chesapeake Bay to their sources in the Appalachian Mountains. George Washington was sent out to survey that area at age 17 and 18. And in 1751-52, the House of Burgesses, familiar with his experience in crossing the Blue Ridge, crossing the Allegheny Mountain, sent him out there to warn on behalf of the British Crown, to warn the French not to try to occupy the land at the forks of the Ohio, that is where the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers come together to form the Ohio River, which is the center of modern Pittsburgh, of course. And so Washington goes over the mountains. The map that he had, which is pitifully inadequate for the area west of the mountains, it's fairly good for the Atlantic coast, was published by two surveyors in 1751 named Joshua Fry and Peter Jefferson. Peter Jefferson was the father of Thomas Jefferson. So a little bit of a small world there. But that map, that terrain that George Washington encountered, which was very poorly described by Jefferson and Fry, was the area that was sort of the mental map that he kept with him for the rest of his life, going north by northwest, out the Potomac River, over the mountains, was his vision of a westward path for the new nation. He attempted to build a canal along it. He surveyed that area. He took that trip multiple times, including part of the British force that was defeated at Braddock's defeat in 1754. He purchased a lot of land in that area. And so his drive was to go over those hills and to see those mountain ridges and to see what came next. He notes at one point in particular that there was an excellent quality of coal around that area. And there's a premonition there of the fact that this was going to become, in many ways, the industrial heartland of America, that we're going to have the steel factory, coal-fired steel factories that became the arsenal of democracy for the Civil War, for Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War, and then for the United States and its allies again in World War II. So that was the future that I think George Washington was pointing to. His mental maps were well established in that direction.
Gotcha. And so Washington would be one person that you studied. Who are the other founders that you studied in the book?
Well, two of the others that have decisively different mental maps and that had terrific consequences for public policy, Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. Of course, they were George Washington's Secretary of the Treasury and Secretary of State, two top appointees in the first in his administration. And Hamilton writes at one point about if you look at the United States, New England is on your left hand and produces all the shipping and merchants and so forth. They have the trees to chop down and make trees to make ships out of. And the South, the Carolinas on the South, which produce copper and cotton and other crops and so forth. What are you looking at when New England is on your left and South Carolina is on your right? And the answer is you're looking at the Atlantic Ocean. You're looking at those invisible sea lanes, the great commerce going all across the world. And if you read Hamilton in his prescient letters to Robert Morris and James Duane, where he talks about how when he's a 20-something aide to General Washington, and he talks about how we need a national bank and to set up a commercial currency based on national debt and circulating currency. policies that he puts into effect more than a decade later as Washington Secretary of the Treasury. This is his vision of his mental map. It goes back, really, I think, to when he was growing up in horrible circumstances on the sugar island of St. Croix in the Caribbean. His father deserts the family. His mother dies next to him in bed. The guardian commits suicide. Hamilton is employed by these New York merchants that have an office in St. Croix, and they decide to bamboozle to go to New York for medical treatment. They put the 17-year-old Hamilton in charge. And he starts ordering the captains to go to a different place. He collects debts that they'd never been able to collect. He makes currency transactions in the multiple currencies that were in use in the Caribbean islands. This was a Danish-owned island in those days. He's speaking multiple languages. He was totally fluent in French as well as English, and had some command of other languages as well. So Hamilton was acquainted with those sea lanes from the very beginning. And he had a vision of commerce, and he wanted the United States to be a commercial nation, to be a nation that got economic growth. Remember, the whole idea of economic growth was a little unusual in the 18th century. These societies had been in situations when you look at the data about GDP per capita or something, it's kind of a straight line. It goes up and down a little bit here and there, but it's not a growth economy. Hamilton perceives a growth economy and fashions his policies to have a national bank, to create a currency that would go out. His policies for the national debt that was intended also to be a source of capital for a capitalist economy and a mercantile economy. This is the foundation of his thinking, his mental map. He writes, in his various reports about Hamburg and Amsterdam and Bremen and the other city-states of Italy, the commercial enterprises. And he wants North Atlantic ports in the United States to be commercial enterprises like that, which, of course, did come to pass. Thomas Jefferson, a very different outlook. The one book that he published, Notes on Virginia, published during the 1780s, he includes at the front of his a copy slightly updated of his father and Joshua Fry, Peter Jefferson and Joshua Fry's map of 1751 that shows vaguely the diagonal ridges of the Blue Ridge and the Allegheny Mountain and so forth, and not very much detail the interior. He writes about a wide range. That map also includes parts of what are now Pennsylvania, and of course Virginia included what is now West Virginia and Kentucky. The Ohio River Valley is included as far out as the Mississippi River. He writes about all these things. He goes farther west. He talks about the Missouri River, which in the 1780s wasn't in the United States until Louisiana Purchase in 1803. He tells you how far it is from Santa Fe to Mexico City, and he actually gets the mileage pretty close to correct. So he's got this vast westward vision of a wide and fertile land beyond the mountains that could be filled with yeoman farmers and people who would act in deference to their natural leaders like Thomas Jefferson, I think was part of his vision. But this was part of his vision. The map doesn't include New England. It doesn't include New York City. It doesn't include, includes very little of the coast of Virginia. Jefferson's Notes on Virginia doesn't mention the coast at all. And so you can see from that mental map that Thomas Jefferson hoped for the new republic was quite different from Hamilton. He opposed Hamilton's assumption of debt that would create a national debt. He opposed the National Bank of the United States. He opposed the whole idea of a commercial republic and of encouraging manufacturers and encouraging capitalist development. He wanted the yeoman farmer to be his symbol, and he set out some policies to do that. That turned out to be successful. He had a bill in the Confederation Congress to establish the Northwest Territory, as non-slave territory, that is everything west of Pennsylvania, north of the Ohio River. That ultimately got into the bill by the machinations of a whole bunch of other different people. But he sowed that idea. He had the plan for those township grids, square miles with 6x6 square miles making up a township with one township reserved for supportive education. Well, you can see his work if you get on a cross-country flight on a clear day, anywhere from somewhere on the East Coast, crossing the country over to Orange County, California. You can see those square miles and those townships laid off the way that Thomas Jefferson wanted. So Jefferson and Hamilton both contributed important things to the development of the United States. And those things arose, I think, in large part out of their mental maps. So I tried to give readers a sense of this. And Gordon Wood, one of the great generation of colonial and early republic historians, was kind enough to say that in a blurb for the book that no one else has looked at the founders in quite this way, and that I've managed to contribute something to a conversation building on the brilliant work of a lot of other people.
Yeah, well, it does sound very interesting and original. I've never heard of anything really in this sort of research area. You've touched on already so many of the sort of themes that kind of come to mind when I think of the founders, the early republic. Maybe let me start and ask, Washington's from Virginia, but he never has any political party. He sort of gets lumped in closer to Hamilton in a more sort of federalist or nationalist wing of sort of political thought at the time. But it's really after with John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and Hamilton and James Madison who really where parties actually come online. And I'm wondering how these sort of mental maps, if you could dive further, sort of you already touched on it a little bit, how geography and these mental maps come in when we're talking about the creation of political parties in the United States.
Well, the political parties come about in the 1790s by the actions of a bunch of men, including George Washington, including those all those that you mentioned, all of whom hated political parties and thought the concept of political parties was awful. They, some of them at least had read Edmund Burke's contemporaneous defense of political parties in Britain when Edmund Burke actually, you know, he was the MP for Bristol and he voted against the local interests in Bristol and he maintained that he had independent judgment. Well, the people in Bristol didn't vote for him anymore. He didn't run in Bristol in the next election. He was elected in a pocket borough controlled by his ally, the Marquess of Rockingham. Edmund Burke believed in political parties. The founders generally didn't, but they formed them. And I think, you know, out of genuine disagreement about major substantive issues, I've just been talking about the different approaches that Jefferson and Hamilton brought to the questions of trade, of commerce, of finance, that were fundamental in the early republic that derived from their different mental maps of the country and what they how they thought the country should grow. Those were major substantive issues. This wasn't, you know, the term that a lot of political journalists use, they're bickering about something. Well, they were arguing about serious things. They weren't bickering out of which one was going to get to play with a toy for the next 3 minutes. These were serious arguments. The other thing that the founders faced, certainly from 1793 on and presaged before that, was that there was a world war between revolutionary and Napoleonic France on the one hand, and royal and mercantile and parliamentary Britain on the other hand. And the founders had different allegiances. Jefferson and Madison were very much anti-British and tended to favor France, though they were frustrated by that sometimes. Hamilton tended to favor Britain, and although he was attacked for that on occasion. Washington, trying to evoke a position of neutrality, declares in, I think, 1795 that he wants a policy of neutrality in this world war. He doesn't want us to take either sides. He devotes considerable space to that position in his farewell address, where he specifically endorses the Neutrality Act. Mm-hmm. And that he had managed to get the Congress to pass. So those were very serious issues. So we have political parties, we have a mechanism, and you know, if you listen, when you get a serious issue like that that's really fundamental, you're going to get something that look like parties. I wrote an earlier book called Our First Revolution, which is a story, which is telling the story of the glorious revolution of 1688-89, primarily in Britain, in England, ultimately Scotland and Ireland, that had important ramifications for the colonies. But the issue in Britain was basically whether you're going to have a Catholic king or not, at a time when Europe was rent by religious wars, and a Catholic king who was going to abolish basically rule without parliament in a sort of absolutism. And King James II also was on the was in the process of abolishing the colonial legislatures. And that was over, that war was, that issue was very fundamental. So in Britain has elections, three elections, 1679, 1681, which you get the equivalent of political parties. They prepare pamphlets on each side and circulate them in coffee houses. Sounds like the internet, doesn't it?
Right.
These are written by different people. Then when William of Orange, the nephew and son-in-law of King James, decides he's going to come over to England with an army of 25,000, he's stadtholder of the Netherlands, he prepares pamphlets announcing his intentions and so forth, smuggling in there and circulating them through coffee houses. So this was political parties that came into existence over some very fundamental and important questions. And that's what the founders had to deal with. Jefferson, after 1800 and his very narrow election, with the complication that his vice presidential candidate was trying to reverse the order of the ticket, Aaron Burr, he tries to get everybody into his own group, but recognizes that he's not successful in doing that. His party becomes dominant. The Republicans, as they generally call them, some people say that's the genesis of our Democratic Party. I think that our Democratic Party really begins later with Andrew Jackson.
Right.
But you know, this was the parties that grew out of this. I mean, Washington's neutrality was also regional. I think one of the consequences of his geography, he didn't like the Southern way of life very much. You know, he was from Virginia. Virginia seceded from the Union. His step-grandson, his daughter married Robert E. Lee and occupied Arlington House across the river from Washington, and then, of course, becomes the commander of the major Confederate army and so forth. But Washington's sympathies were otherwise. He takes two presidential tours in his geographical quest to know the colonies better, first in the northern states and then in the southern states. And he very much admires the spirit of enterprise, the cleanliness and new progressive economy of New England and the New York and so forth in those states, the area in New Jersey and New York State and Pennsylvania that he'd occupied with his armies as commander-in-chief. He doesn't like the South very much. His one journey outside the United States with his consumptive brother Lawrence was to Barbados, a sugar-growing 90% slave territory. He hated that. He didn't like, he didn't send troops to fight the British takeover in 1780 of South Carolina. Coastal South Carolina was about 90% slaves. He didn't see that. My guess is that he saw that as, well, if the British hold on to South Carolina and that doesn't get into our Union, maybe that's not so bad. My own view is that Washington looked north. His view was to look to the west, but north by northwest. And that if he had somehow survived the Civil War, if we could do a counterfactual like that, he would have been on the north rather than the south. And one proof of that is in the last year of his life in 1799, he sat in that room upstairs in his study in Mount Vernon, and he wrote out with his quill pen a will in which he freed all of his slaves and provided for their support for the rest of their lives. Just as he was aware he was setting precedents when he resigned his command of the Continental Army and when he declined to run for a third term for president, he's setting precedents in public life. He also set a precedent, I think, in his private life for freeing his slaves, a precedent that unfortunately was not followed by some of the other founders like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison.
Right. I'd actually love to delve a little bit deeper into how geography or sort of the northern and southern fractures within the early republic and how that plays in with the issue of slavery, because even though slavery existed in the South and was pretty quickly abolished in either immediately or gradually in most of the northern colonies that then turned into states, basically all of the leading founders and the colonists, whether they held slaves or did not hold slaves, found slavery to be a moral wrong. But, you know, of course, over time that changes. And I'm wondering if there's anything in your book or anything in your research about the parties or anything else about American history of how geography or these sorts of mental maps and visions for the country based on that play in.
Well, I think the Revolution made a huge difference in attitudes towards slavery. I mean, Benjamin Franklin, born in 1706, grew up in Boston, hightailed it out of Boston as a teenager, went to Philadelphia, spent a year over in London. Benjamin Franklin owned slaves in his young years. George Washington, of course, owned slaves, inherited three slaves when his father died when he was 11 years old. This was common practice. But the Revolution, I think, by having the colonists assert their cause in the form of an abstract desire for liberty, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's pretty hard to square that with slavery.
Right.
You think about those phrases for a little while, and Thomas Jefferson had such a great capacity for phrase making, for brilliant use of the language. That was his greatest single skill, and it was on display there. And the attitudes change. People who in the 1740s and 50s had taken slavery absolutely for granted, by the 1780s are taking quite a different view. So in the 1780s, you have the legislatures of Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and Rhode Island providing for gradual abolition of slavery. You have the courts of Massachusetts and New Hampshire providing for the gradual abolition of slavery. You have the Republic of Vermont adopting a constitution which they say no slavery exists here now or forevermore. You get laggards. New York comes along under Governor John Jay in 17, gradual abolition of slavery. New Jersey, always a little late, even before the time of Tony Soprano, comes in with the gradual abolition of slavery in 1806. So they're abolishing slavery. Even Delaware, which remains a slave state, by 1860 census, 94% of the people of African descent in Delaware are free. They're not slaves. So there was a definite movement against slavery in the early republic, which was, I think, prompted by the Revolution. It would be hard to say that you were risking war, risking charges of treason in the cause of liberty, and still hold slaves. Now, obviously, some people didn't manage it. Slavery became more profitable as in the 19th century with the emergence of the cotton industry and the southern cotton lands, something that the founders certainly did not anticipate. Nobody did. You have large elements of tragedy. But the view that some people have been propagating, the 1619 Project, and the idea that the American Revolution was prompted by people who were trying to maintain slavery, is simply not an accurate view. And it prompted this significant movement against slavery. Before the American Revolution, except for the Quakers, you had very few people in the English-speaking world, very few people in the European world that had a principled view, a principled stand against slavery. Afterwards, that's different.
Oh yeah, I agree. And not only the northern states, but all of the southern representatives who voted for the Northwest, was it the Northwest Passage?
The Northwest Ordinance of 1787.
Yeah, they all, says, all of the southern states agreed. All of the southern states had banned the slave trade.
Yeah, in 1787, you get slavery's banned west of Pennsylvania, north of the Ohio River. And they also, of course, in the Constitution provide for, and in Congress absolutely do, ban the international slave trade in 1808, the first year that it, the first day that it's permitted to ban, Congress permitted to ban it by the Constitution.
Right. Well, actually, so thinking about the Northwest Ordinance, that kind of maybe segues us into thinking about westward expansion, the gradual growth of our country from, you know, sea to shining sea. So do you have any representatives in the book of sort of a Western mental map or a frontier map?
Well, Jefferson obviously is thinking about the West. Notes on Virginia. When you get to the Missouri River and Santa Fe and so forth, he's thinking about the West. And even, you know, is he anticipating the Mexican War and writing about Mexico City? I'm not sure I'd go that far, but clearly they have an idea. He has an idea of moving west. James Madison had a certain, you know, whose major preoccupation was the sort of theoretical foundation for the Constitution, mm-hmm. the idea that in a large geographic republic and a culturally diverse republic, you would have, if you had a structure of government that had countervailing interests and checks and balances, you could avoid. Tend to avoid tyranny of the majority that he saw in some of the state legislatures. So Madison has a vision beyond that, though. He's got a Drang nach Südwest, as I say. He's talking about the Southwest. Madison is thought of as a theoretical guy, but he was also a person who was quite forceful when he thought that was necessary. One of the things that you know, in the 1780s, he's spending a lot of time arguing with John Jay, who was the secretary, sort of the foreign secretary of the Articles of Confederation Congress, about navigation on the Mississippi River. Jay is saying, well, we don't have to ask the Spanish for a concession on this. The Spain owned the territory west of the river. Because they're not going to be any people there for 20 years or so. So it's an academic question, right? Madison is saying, oh, no, we've got to get that and so forth. He's cognizant that you've got Virginians going over the mountains in what would become Kentucky. It wasn't separate then. And he's interested in navigation on there. And as president in 1811, he does something that I think no other president's ever done before, which is basically annexes something to the continental United States, not by treaty, but by military action. West Florida, which consisted really of places of what is now the southern tips of Alabama, Mississippi, and the parishes of Louisiana north of Lake Pontchartrain and east of the Mississippi River, the Florida parishes, as they're called. So everything from basically Pensacola west to Baton Rouge, there were American settlers there. And Madison just says, well, look, I'm just going to send the troops in. I think this was covered by the Louisiana Purchase, he says. Basically, nobody else thought that. And there wasn't very good evidence for it. He says, I think it's covered by the Louisiana Purchase, and we're going to take it. And the United States did. And it is part of the United States to this day. And that was, things might have gone differently if Andrew Jackson lost the Battle of New Orleans, but that's a whole nother subject. So you do have that southwestern thrust there versus Washington, more of a northwestern thrust. He's trying to open up the Ohio Territory. He's trying to open up what was declared by the Northwest Ordinance in 1787 to be non-slave territory. And he's trying to link his northern Virginia to that.
What's the significance of the Lewis and Clark expedition out west?
Well, that's another answer to your question, isn't it? Jefferson is obviously thinking about, sending people to the Pacific and so forth. The fact is that, we had American interest. You have the German immigrant William Astor set up, John Jacob Astor set up Astoria on what is now the mouth of the Columbia River, state of Oregon, as a fur trading post. And, you know, those lands in the Missouri River Valley and going over the border into what is Washington and Oregon were slave. Those areas were claimed at that. You had various claims. I mean, Spain, Britain, Russia, and the United States were all staking claims to that Pacific territory, and were not exerting them in any effective way. I mean, the Mexican government hardly had any sway over basically an almost entirely unpopulated California. And it's the project really of the founders' sons, the next generation, to establish American hegemony in there. And John Quincy Adams' transcontinental treaty with Florida gets Spain to agree that they have nothing up above the 42nd parallel, the current northern boundary of California. And he gets an agreement with Russia that they're not going to go below 5440, which is the low southern limit of what is now Alaska. And they have a British-U.S. sort of condominium where we agree that we both have claims to British, what is now British Columbia, Washington, and Oregon, and we're not going to settle them right now. Ultimately settled by President Polk. So that's the work of another generation. But Jefferson definitely is thinking Pacific there. I mean, the curious thing about Jefferson in some ways is his mental maps were mental. He never went west much himself. He skedaddles west when the British troops come to Charlottesville when he's the governor of Virginia in 1780. He hightails it out on his fastest horse. He was a good horseman. But he doesn't get as far west as his father, Peter Jefferson, the surveyor plantation owner, did. He travels, his one trip to Europe is ambassador to France. They don't call it ambassador, but minister to France. He does do some traveling, but he goes down the Rhine and ascends the highest cathedral tower in each town to look around. But you notice he sort of does it from on up high. He goes to Strasbourg, now in France, within some people's lifetime in Germany. The Strasbourg Cathedral Tower was the highest structure, man-made structure in the world at that time. Jefferson goes to the top and looks at the Rhine River, goes right by Strasbourg and so forth. He doesn't mingle much. He was interested in the Palladio's architecture. He had his Quattro Libri books, four books of architecture. When he goes to Italy, he collects some moth. He collects some silk moths. He wants to create a silk industry in Virginia. He smuggles them out of Milano. But he doesn't bother to go farther east to the Palladio villas to see them in Vicenza and Verona. And the Veneto. Traveling was kind of rough and unpleasant in those days, and you can't blame Jefferson perhaps for not wanting to go through it, but he takes things to his study. So you go to Monticello today, there are Indian artifacts collected by Lewis and Clark in the front room. There's the memory, at least, of the French wine cellar that he gets from France. There are mementos of his reading and everything, but basically, he's a homebody. He creates one Monticello after another. He builds this house on the top of a mountain in a estate where everybody else had their grand houses on rivers so they could send boats directly to England. He builds them on top of the mountain. There's not enough water. He has slaves carrying the water up the mountain, and it's not a small drive. If you've probably been there. It's not a small drive up that mountain. Imagine carrying a whole bunch of water. Ugh. Jefferson, it's impractical. He tears down one house and builds another multiple times. The house has wonderful rooms for him and rather cramped rooms for the adoring women and other relatives that live with him and guests at Monticello. the slaves, he's got it constructed so the slaves live out of sight of his major rooms. He's creating his own maps. He's enjoying mental maps. He's enjoying learning about things that's geographically oriented all over the world, sending Lewis and Clark to the Pacific. He would have said sending Lewis. Lewis was from Albemarle County and was from another rich family. Clark was not. So Jefferson always said Lewis was in charge, even though Lewis always treated Clark as an equal. So that was, you know, he liked doing that. And as president, he was hugely successful with Congress, even though he seldom appeared in public, made almost no public speeches of any kind, was not, as Henry Adams writes, was never seen in any major city. Dealt with politicians around his grand dinner table with ex-French chef, French wines. Contemporary politics was not allowed to be a subject, but he would perhaps introduce gentle persuasion, and he would talk about a million different things, scientific and historic and biological, that he had learned about, charming everybody, getting his way at least the first 6 years of his presidency, but not engaging in what we think of as rough and tumble politics.
Well, I would love to ask more questions, but unfortunately, Michael, I'm out of time. So I appreciate you coming on. The book is Mental Maps of the Founders, and we will link it in our show notes so people can go buy it and read it. If there's anything else that any other places or any other work that you'd like to plug, where else should people go?
Well, my columns are in the Washington Examiner, copy on affairs of the day, and I had a number of other books, so I'd be happy if you want to just buy all of them. That would be nice.
Perfect. Well, thanks again, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations with ISI. If you've enjoyed this episode, be sure to check out our website at isi.org/resources to see all that we offer our members, including the Intercollegiate Review, select Modern Age articles, debates, lectures, and of course, this podcast. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to rate and review, and we will see you next time on Conservative Conversations with ISI.